Thank you, everybody, very much for coming. And thank you for taking all the time on this very important evening. Tonight we are, as our Targum just mentioned, we're going to be thinking and learning for the Aliyas Neshama of, unfortunately, those nine children who are 10 now, unfortunately, who are killed today in Eretz Yisrael in flash floods. And they should know no more tzar, they and their mishpachos, and also those who are wounded should have a refuah shlema, who should be protected from such sorrows. This evening we're gathering together for a very important moment, and that is to focus our attention on somebody who really formed the framework for a lot of what our community is, what it means to be a Jew engaged in the world is today, certainly in the Western world, in America. And we are very privileged to be hosting Rabbi Targum, who's going to be leading this show this evening. Just by way of introduction, I wanted to share just a brief idea in the name of Rav Lichtenstein as we start this evening. And that is that, as we know, we're in a period moving towards Lag BaOmer. And the Gemara in Yevamos, in the very, very brief amount of time that the Gemara spends focusing on this period of Sfiras Omer, it tells us just a very simple formula as to what happened. Rabbi Akiva, as we are told, has 12,000 zugos shel talmidim. He has 12,000 pairs of talmidim. They all died during this period. We're pretty familiar with that part of it. However, the Gemara continues and says, "V'haya ha'olam shamem ad shabar Rabbi Akiva etzel Rabbi Senu shabadaram." The world was desolate until Rabbi Akiva decided to come to the Talmud and those students in the south. And who were they? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Lazar ben Shamua. And they established the Torah. They reestablished Torah, which was lost at this point in time. You can imagine the desolation of not just the physical landscape, but the spiritual landscape. We're at the time of Hadrianic persecutions. Terrible calamity at this point in time. What Rav Lichtenstein asks in this particular episode, and this is a shir he gave 10 years ago, as we approached Lag BaOmer, he says the following, is what was the content of the Torah that he taught those Talmidim, Shevadarim? Meaning, what was the curriculum of Yeshiva Phase 2? Basic question. It's important because that's the Torah that we get. So what shifted? What changed? And how could that really make up? Did that really make up? Could that really make up for what was missing, what had been destroyed? So what Rav Lichtenstein does is a beautiful idea, and he focuses on the fact that it's a little surprising to think that you could have so many people who are learning Torah day and night, and so many of them had so much disregard from each other, they were so disrespectful to one another, that they warranted this thing. I mean, that's a pretty serious allegation the Gemara is laying on them. So Rav Lichtenstein points out 2 points. Number one is when you look at this Gemara, there's a difference between what we're calling not disgracing and honoring. There's a difference between kibbutz and bizayon. Right, so a halachic example of that is that a person has towards a parent a chiyuv of kavod, of kibbutz, to honor one's parent. However, in certain circumstances, a parent can forfeit on that. A person can be moichel al kavodai, a mother or a father, in certain circumstances. However, let's say a parent is moichel, forfeits there or decides to forgive on their own kavod. That is not license for the child to embarrass them or disgrace them, because there's a difference between lack of honor, neutrality, and disgrace. Say similarly on the flip side, says Rav Lichtenstein over here, the Talmidim weren't disgracing one another; they were neutral. There was something missing from the equation. There was not this positivity between the two, between them, which was what was the lack, which was what was the void over here. Moreover, what Rav Lichtenstein points out as very, very clearly he does, and that is that the pagam over here was shilonagov kovod zebozer. It was an individual issue. It wasn't a collective issue. They respected the community. They respected the groups. They didn't respect the individuals one to one. There was a certain, we'll call it, you know, subtle interaction that was missing between these individuals, between these people. And this is what was going on over here. So what happened? What was the resolution? How did Rabbi Akiva repair this? So it says he went to the Talmidim Shevadarim, and Rav Lichtenstein argues that the Torah that he taught, the Torah that he went to, we'll call it phase two of the yeshiva system, was the Torah of Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, that Derech Eretz precedes the Torah. If you don't have the prerequisite, you don't have the foundation, there's no way that possibly you can amalgamate and incorporate the Torah that you're learning itself, because that was what was lacking first time around. Two examples of this just happened to, just sort of added on to him, to what Lichtenstein was saying. One example is the Gemara, later on in Nachas, and Daf Samach Ches Amabez, where there was a Rabbi Tarfon had a question. Rabbi Tarfon was a colleague of Rabbi Akiva, says, Ma ben koidim ala oimer la koidim shtei alechem. He says, what's the halachic difference between the korban ha-oimer, sacrifice on Pesach is brought, and the korban shtei alechem is brought on Pesach? What's the halachic significance and difference between those two periods? So, Amar lefonav Yehuda bar Nechemia. Yehuda bar Nechemia, it's not called Rav. Yehuda bar Nechemia said to him, Lo yomart koidim la oimer, shekeinu huta bichlal la yaitzel ahejot. Of course, before the oimer, nobody's allowed to eat. After the Omer, you can bring karbanas on the Mizbeach from the new grain. After the Shtei Alechem on Shavuos, then everybody can actually, other way around, sorry, it's Hutar Le, the Hedyot, after for regular people, after Pesach, and after Shavuos, even the Mizbeach can have the Chadash. Tamar, Kodim Shtei Alechem, Shehu Hutar Michal Hedyot. Shasar Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon was so embarrassed. This is an obvious thing. The Torah, this is pretty explicit in the Torah, that this is what happens. So Amar Rabbi Akiva Yehuda, Savu Ponecha Sheshavtes Azaken Timani Im Tarich Yamim. Says, I saw you gloat, I saw the color come to your face as you embarrassed Rabbi Tarfon. He says, I would be surprised if you were to have long days. And the Gemara goes on to say that Yehuda ben Nechemia passed away at an early age. And once again, what we see from here is the notion that Rabbi Akiva's perspective has shifted, right? Rabbi Akiva's perspective on what we can teach Torah from today until tomorrow, but if it isn't Derech Eretz Kadmo LaTorah, there's no way to really be able to appreciate that. That's what the Gemara is indicating over here. So in a second and last tier, what Rabbi Lichtenstein does is he takes it one step further. He says that he quotes Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua is none other than student of Rabbi Akiva. He's one of the five Talmidim Shabadara, right? He's one of the five Talmidim in the south. So what does he say? Meaning, what did he learn in yeshiva? Right? You know, everybody comes home from yeshiva and they say, what did you learn? I'm sure you spent all your time learning good vortlach, right? Rather than, you know, you've been doing learning by Basra and Rashbam, and then they say, okay, say a good vort at the table. That wasn't all you're learning. Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, what did you hear? What do you hear your ABC teach? Says Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua in Pirkei Avos, Perek Dalei Mishnah Yud Beis. Yehi chavoy talmidcha chaviv alecha kishelcha. Let your Talmid's cover be more important than your own honor. And the respect you give to your colleagues, like the moira that you give to the fear you give to your Rebbe, who moira rabcha. But when you fear your Rebbe, kamora shamayim. Think of God. Meaning to say that's the level of power that we're talking about over here. Rav Lichtenstein says, if you think about this for just a moment, just to appreciate how powerful this is, that means that incorporated into the relationship of how we treat each other or how we treat other people who are expressions of Torah in this world is not simply, we'll call it, Bein Adam Lachavero. There's an aspect of the actual Kabbalah Torah is to be found in the way we treat others, because there's more a Shemayim even in the person that we're respecting. That's how deep it goes. That's what Rav Lichtenstein argues. In his own words, he says, Lag Ba'omer is almost upon us. Just to quote his own words. But Shavuos is not far away. The issue of trusting one another with respect should be viewed in the perspective of Shavuos and our preparations for receiving the Torah. On one level, this is significant in terms of the manner of our acceptance of the Torah. Chazal emphasized that Am Yisrael stood facing the mountain as one person with one heart. This does not mean to say that there was complete unanimity concerning every personal, social, and national issue. They're Jews, after all. Obviously, there were differences of opinion. Indeed, that is a healthy state of affairs. But such differences of opinion should not entail scorn for another. Rather, they should be expressed with appropriate respect, with readiness to hear a different opinion, and allowing others to speak up. And I think who could represent that more? I remember one of the quotes when Rav Lichtenstein came to Yeshiva University based Medrash, which is such a powerful idea, is that modern Orthodox needs to learn how to express subtlety with passion. Think about what the brilliance of that. It's very easy to get up on a soapbox and say one message, one thing to do. It's only Torah. It's only Israel. It's only this. It's very easy to do that. What happens when you say it's a lot of things? It's complex. There's a balance. There's tension. There's grayscale, right? But can you be passionate about that? That's the struggle we have. Rabbi Lichtenstein is saying is that we have to be able to respect that in order to be able to do this. And who other than a person like Rabbi Lichtenstein? I remember at the Hespedim, which were given in Yeshiva when I was in Yeshiva. So many stories came up, and one particular story really exemplifies this trait was that he was once walking out of the library, the Yeshiva University library, and there's a particular time with a lot of books being stolen. You know, books have legs. So they instituted a policy where it was a zero tolerance that, you know, everybody had to have their bag checked. So Rav Lichtenstein was walking out the library, and there he is, you know, you can imagine. And somebody says to him, so the guard says, no, you can go. He says, I don't think you looked at the bottom of the bag yet. right? There was such a level of yashra, such a level of respect, such a level of being part of society, the Derech Eretz Shekar Melotor, and that's exactly what Rabbi Akiva was teaching. It's with great honor that that our community appreciates the legacy of who Rav Lichtenstein was, but really is, and what he represents, because Olam Da'avdon, there are so few people who have such a capacity of balance, such a capacity of being in so many worlds at one time. It is to the great credit of Rav Tarragon, who really is taking out of his time of an incredibly busy schedule to be here to share with us. And Rav Tarragon, of course, needs no introduction in this community. He's a person who has influenced our community in so many ways, and all of us across the internet and across the world through Yeshivas, through our children and beyond, as a beloved Rebbe of so many. When I first met Rabbi Tarragon, I was in Camp Hask 13 years ago, and I remember the connection even from then, and the warmth that we all feel towards Rabbi Tarragon. It is with great honor that we ask him to share a special shir for us.
Please help us. Good evening, good Arab Shabbos, everyone. And those who counted the Omer, a good 26th day of the Omer. My plan was not originally to mention Rav Lichtenstein's Derech Eretz, but Rabbi Trump picked up on it so eloquently. And it's not incidental, because amongst all of your traits, and I've learned to appreciate and respect them, your enthusiasm, your warmth, your innovation in Talmud Torah, I think you get it. I think you understand what Derech Eretz is. And I think sometimes people conflate Derech Eretz and Chesed and Midos. They're very, very different parts of our Avodas Hashem. Chesed is, by and large, the acts that we perform to relieve people of their suffering and their distress, by and large. Derech Eretz is much deeper. Derech Eretz is the respect we show people, even when it's not tangible, it's an act of chesed. Rav Lichtenstein would never ask for a ride to a wedding. He'd be invited to attend weddings, and he would take four buses. He was a Masada Kiddushin, because he didn't feel appropriate being served. So he would take a bus from Gush to Yerushalayim, and then a bus from Yerushalayim to Tel Aviv, and then a bus from Tel Aviv to Haifa, and then a bus from Haifa to the local wedding. Four buses. Leave it to the Israeli Bachram, not even to offer him a ride or a driver. So we knew that this was our chance to offer him a ride home, because he didn't have a ride home. So we struggle and jockey with one another. Who's going to offer him a ride home? 2 hours uninterrupted with Rav Lichtenstein. Say he would graciously accept a ride, on one condition, that he wouldn't sit in the front seat. Because he didn't feel right separating a wife from her husband the night that they could be together for a wedding. And you can imagine how mortified my wife was sitting in the front seat with her Rav Lichtenstein in the back seat. But that was the ticket of admission. That was the price you had to pay to get Rav into the car. And I promise you, I must think of Rav Lichtenstein, I mean, this month probably 20 times a day, because I take it on myself this month to try to learn his Torah as much as I can, but typically probably 10 times a day easily. Very rarely the Torah he taught me. Very rarely this Chiddush or that Chiddush. More often the Derech Eretz. And every time I get into a car, I'm embarrassed to sit in the front seat, because I don't want to separate a husband and their wife. And I don't want to, if someone's older than me, he deserves to sit in the front seat, not myself, or she deserves to sit in the front seat. You mentioned the Svarim before. We remember Rav Lichtenstein, whose Hasmada and Stuart and his energy level was legendary. He would leave the Beis Medrash every day, 4 minutes and 19 seconds before the bus was meant to pick him up at the bus stop. He timed it. He wouldn't waste any time. You could literally time your watch by the 4 minutes and 19 seconds. But the 4 minutes and 19 seconds was timed for how long it would take him to reach the bus stop, and he would run until his older years. He would run with his sperm under his hands, but it took him about 2 minutes to reach the bus stop, but 2 minutes and 19 seconds to put all the sperm back that he had used that day. This is the Rosh Yeshiva, one of the Gedolei Hador. Someone could put back your sperm for you. You have to make a bus. But Derech Eretz isn't chesed. You're doing a chesed by allowing a wife and a husband. I mean, you could call it that, but I don't think we have to employ the word chesed just to quantify important activities. It's just sensitivity, respect, mindfulness. There was once some rally. I obviously didn't attend when he was at Rosh Hashiva at YU. And it was a rally in Washington for some Israel-based political need. And you've been to those rallies, 4 hours on the bus, 4 hours back, 4 hours at the rally. You're exhausted. You're barely walking off the bus. Let's get home as quickly as possible and recover. So someone that day was tasked with walking Rav Lichtenstein home from the bus in Washington Heights to wherever he was living in Washington Heights. And he was waiting and waiting and waiting. And no Rav Lichtenstein. So he was about to go home, thinking Rav Lichtenstein had wandered off on his own. And let me give one final check on the bus. He walks back onto the bus. And Rav Aaron is there cleaning up the potato chip bags and the cookie wrappers. And when he asked Rav Aaron, it's time to go home, he said, what, the bus driver didn't have as hard a day as we did? He wants to get home also to his family. So where do you think I am on buses all the time, cleaning up wrappers? And because you're haunted by his image and you're haunted by the types of, it was mindfulness and respect and just awareness of other people. And I think we do a disservice by trying to quantify everything as a chesed. Not everything in life can be called a chesed, but that doesn't make it less important. Sometimes it makes it more important. As I mentioned, it's the framework, it's the casing. Torah doesn't say chesed kadma l'Torah. Torah is chesed al l'shona. There's a nice relationship between Torah and chesed, but derech eretz kadma l'Torah is living in this world, even as we soar and study a different world and try to reach the Rabbonu Shalom. And I could literally tell you 2 hours of stories about Rav Lichtenstein's derech eretz. And I think he taught us just to respect human beings. There's a tremendous respect for human beings of all stripes. He understood the complexity of the human condition. He studied, when we asked him why he studied literature, he said, because he didn't use these words, but I'll use these words. It's a hechsher mitzvah to help him avoid the isser of lotonu. There's an isser in Parshas Kedoshim of lotonu. You shouldn't insult people. Not to insult people, you have to understand the context, who people are, what they're emotional state is, what their background is. You have to be able to have high EQ. And the irony is that he had tremendous EQ, even though he wasn't charismatic. He was very shy. He was very retiring. It was too artificial for him to be a back-slapping Rebbe and put his arm around you. He didn't know how to make small talk. You can imagine these car rides were very, very awkward. In fact, one of my favorite moments, and I'll begin to share in a few minutes, when we were in Hask, so I really appreciated the value of mainstreaming special needs and regular needs boys. So in the yeshiva, we started a special needs program around 11 years ago. So the special needs boys typically are less inhibited. We would live in quaking fear of Lichtenstein. We wouldn't sit at his table. We'd talk to him with b'dechila or achima. We'd go to the mikvah. We'd check our words. But they'd be much less inhibited. So one day, he's at the lunch table eating his lunch, and one of the special needs boys, Meir from Paramus, sits down next to him. And I'm saying, what is Rav Lichtenstein going to do to break the ice? Because he just didn't know how to break the ice. It was all Torah and it was all ideas. And he just had no repertoire for small talk. So he turned to this boy, Meir, and he says, and it was so cute, he said, so, Meir, how's the weather? That was the extent of his small talk vocabulary. He knew the moment was upon him. He just didn't know. He talked about sports, talked about the food. He just didn't know. So he said, Meir, how's the weather? He went on. So Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Chump, I think he'd be very proud of you and of what you're doing. And Amir Hashem, continue, Derech Eretz Kadma L'Torah. I would encourage people to use that word in English because Derech Eretz has become a slogan, and just respecting people, understanding their background, showing them respect, being mindful of the moment where you are, and just adapting yourself to that situation. But tonight's topic is, of course, Rav Lichtenstein's view on Eretz Yisrael. I think he made some very powerful impacts on the way we viewed the state of Israel, we as Talmidim, we as a community, and not just the way we view it, but I think the actual Dati Lumi, national religious community in Eretz Yisrael. And I want to try to highlight some of them through some of the sources, which I don't think I got a copy of. There are some sources. Thank you. Thank you. I think the primary change that he made is as follows. We all believe that we're living through a spectacularly different era, one of renewal, one of drastic change. We've returned to our homeland. We've returned to sovereignty. We've returned to the epicenter of Jewish history. Mitzvot have become augmented. We're now wrestling with mitzvot, which we never dealt with in 2,000 years. Shemitah and Yovel and even Geirus has taken on a different complexion because now Geirus is a quotient, not a personal integrity of the Geir, but of national responsibility. We have half a million Russians living in Eretz Yisrael who we have to try to find some way to include halachically, but who have absolutely no interest or little interest in classic conversion. So if you're living in the shtetl, you gauge a ger based on his own integrity. If you're living in Eretz Yisrael, it's a crossroads of many different factors. So all of a sudden, mitzvahs aren't just augmented, but they're transformed. The mitzvahs and the halachos that we've dealt with for thousands of years now take on different complexion. But more than any of those changes, all of a sudden, the experience seems supernatural, seems unrealistic. It's not practical. Our trajectory isn't rational. We all feel as if we're living through some supernatural era, and the 70th year was an opportunity for us to take a few steps back, and Zayom Asa Hashem, the growth is unprecedented. Just the survival against the threats that we faced over the last 70 years, the maniacs who are assembled on our borders, the lack of war. Baruch Hashem, we feel as if Yad Hashem is very, very tenderly caressing Am Yisrael as it's advancing our history. There's a tendency in that environment to, of course, be enthusiastic, rejoiceful, giddy, grateful, but also to sense the prophecy and to look to the book of prophecy, the book of Tanakh, to try to connect the dots. These are events we've waited for, but quite honestly, these are events that were prophesized ahead of time. I think I was at the White Shul, I mentioned this a few weeks ago. One of the major differences between the way Judaism views history and the Western view of history is Western civilization views, I want to thank Stephen for his help tonight, Western civilization views history as evolutionary and open-ended. We're evolving, we're progressing, and its conclusion is unknown. And we view history as cyclical. Chadish HaMeinu Kekedem. The terminus is already predetermined. The only two questions are who and how fast. How quickly will we get there, and who will take us there? Who will carry us towards that goal? Who will be the, as we talk about Balei HaMasara, who have carried our Masara through Torah, but also who are the Balei Am Yisrael? Who are the people that are going to be carrying Am Yisrael towards that predetermined conclusion? So there's a tendency to look back into Tanakh and to try to draw both reinforcement, inspiration, conviction. Why do I live in the Gush? There are challenges, there are difficulties, but I feel as if the Ribbono Shel Olam wants me there. This is the land of our avos, and I choose a life not based solely on convenience, but based on prophetic mandate. I feel the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to be in Eretz Yisrael, in the Eretz Avos, and those are the choices that we make. But not just for reinforcement, but also for instructions, for guidance. What decisions should we make? How did our Nevi'im envision the return? We look back to previous Geulos, to Ezra, to Mitzrayim. It's very powerful. It's very necessary. But it's also very dangerous. This prophetic thrust, living through a messianic era, can create many, many dangers, of which Chazal were well aware. And interestingly enough, Rav Lichtenstein, to my recollection, didn't speak of them very often, but I want to mention them just to provide the backdrop for how important the frequency that he introduced was. First of all, the great danger of raising expectations which aren't met. Nothing's worse than dashed expectations. 1666, Shabtai Tzvi announces himself as a Mashiach. At least half of the Jewish population sells off their property. Can you imagine half of Woodmere, half of Lawrence Cedarhurst, packing themselves lock, stock, and barrel, moving to Eretz Yisrael? He's proven to be a fraud, and that leads to one of the darkest, bleakest periods in Jewish history, the end of the 17th century, the 18th century. Chassidus, Baruch Hashem, rescued Am Yisrael. I don't know what would have happened to our people without Chassidus. It simply restored our spirit and rejuvenated the sense that we're in a dark space, but the Ribbono Shel Olam is still there for us behind the curtains, behind closed doors. And for this reason, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself suppressed a very clearly detailed messianic map. We're very familiar with Yaakov, source number two, Bikesh Yaakov Legalis Hesakeitz. Yaakov assembles his children. Yaakov lives at a very, very important juncture of history, right as Golus is about to begin. So it's important to lay out some roadmap about the recovery, not just for Mitzrayim, but long term. And Kadosh Baruch Hu says enough. Kadosh Baruch Hu retrieves it from him, suppresses the information, and hence, Bali Kriya know this, Vayigash and Vayichi are fused. There's no space. The only two Parshiyos in the Torah where there's no space. The truth is, it wasn't just Yaakov Avinu. It was another person who lived at a very delicate juncture, Daniel. Daniel is also living through a transition into Galus, and Daniel has his visions, and he wants to reveal the Ketzei Amim. And Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Daniel, Chasom Basefer, Od Chazal Lemoed. So the Ribbono Shel Olam himself senses that too detailed a knowledge of Yemos HaMashiach can be very dangerous, and primarily because people will try to predict the date and the arrival. You can well imagine the type of messianic fervor that existed in the late 15th century, the early 16th century, this massive expulsion of Spanish Jewry, migration easterly. Most of them moved east. Very few moved to Scotland. Most of them moved to Greece and to Italy and to the north of Eretz Yisrael. And, of course, it carried a very, very heavy price tag. The Rambam speaks about this in the 12th century. The Rambam's famous letter to the community of Yemen. The Rambam becomes a hero to the Yemenite Jewish community. They're facing a frustration based on a false Messiah. And the Rambam writes in his very famous Igeres Teman, he says, source number 5, Lefikach, section number 2, Manu chachamim zichronim levracha milachshov hakitzim. Chazal were very, very adamant that we shouldn't try to predict the end of days, even though the Rambam has his own prediction for the restoration of Nevoah, not necessarily the end of days, and many others did. He's referencing the Gemara in Sanhedrin, source number 4, Amr B'yonasan, itapach atzmol shemachashvei kitzim. Rabbi Yochanan says, those people who predict the end of days, their bones should rot. And Rabbi Yonasan says, because these predictions can backfire, these predictions can boomerang. So that's the obvious danger. But there are other types of dangers. Reckless behavior. There's a certain confidence and almost reckless abandon that this sense of living through Yemos HaMashiach can provide. Many of you probably have heard of B'nai Ephraim, the people, the Shevet of Ephraim, who left Mitzrayim earlier because they felt that Geula was on the horizon. A little bit closer to home, Amir Tashem, in another couple of weeks, we'll read Parsha Shlach, and we'll read about the Mapilim, who were just so enthused with this chance to recover a lost opportunity in Eretz Yisrael that they ascend the mountain too quickly. And Lichtenstein would speak with us very often about their ascent versus the ascent in Parshas Yisro, comparing those two aliyos to the mountain, and their ascent was doomed because they were just, it was reckless. They just acted recklessly, and I'm assuming you can try to draw the associations with life in Eretz Yisrael. And a third issue, which we have to be careful about, is not just false designations of messianic events or reckless behavior, but simply the sense that overconfidence, feeling too close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after all, we're partners now. We lived through Galus for 1,700 years, and Hashem lived in a way that was concealed to us, and our Yiras Shamayim was deeply, deeply developed. We don't know HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we can't see Him in our world, we're suffering, we submit to His will. What happens when you live in a world in which you feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is your partner? When you feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is your husband because Shir HaShirim is once again coming to life. So Baruch Hashem, we feel that Abbas Hashem. We feel that connection to the Rabbonu Shel Olam. But sometimes that connection can breed intellectual cockiness, overconfidence, lack of reverence to the Rabbonu Shel Olam. I'm sure you've all been to Eretz Yisrael and seen everyone calling each other Achi, 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 Achi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not Achi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a Melech Malachim Lachim. He's a Adon Kol Abrios. And some of that hierarchy and gravitas can be frayed by too close a relationship. And not just the hierarchy, but also, as I said before, there are a lot of Israeli teenagers or a lot of Israeli 35-year-olds today who aren't religious. One of the pivotal events in that transformation occurred in 2006 when we disengaged from Gaza. It was a tumultuous experience, very tragic, a real national convulsion, and we all lived through it, and my skills as a father were really tried during that period. I had to sit with my children and explain this to them. But a lot of national religious rabbis stood up and said three very, very, in my opinion, infamous words which boomeranged. They said, Hayel lo tiyeh, it won't happen. And what happens if you're a 15-year-old girl, or a boy for that matter, and you wake up the day after, and you've been guaranteed by your rabbanim that it won't happen, and then it happens? It leads to a tremendous crisis of faith and crisis of religion. And I'm asking myself, 70 years after the Holocaust, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu can allow the Holocaust to happen, He can allow the voluntary resettlement of 8,000 Jews by their government, as politically unwise as you may feel it is. This isn't a political statement, but to be so confident that you know the Das Elyon and you know the ways of the Bona Shel Olam, where did this come from, I asked myself. In the Haredi world, you don't have this. And the answer is because the Haredi world is still living in 1861. So the terms of the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu are dictated solely by Yiras Shamayim. For us, there's been a Baruch Hashem, a restoration of Avas Hashem. We feel so close to the Rabbanu Shalom on a day-to-day basis, but sometimes it leads to unbridled cockiness and intimacy that's inappropriate. So there are many, many dangers to too fervent messianic experience and to trying to draw prophecy into this messianic experience. Rav Lichtenstein was adamantly opposed to this. Through nothing he said, he never talked about this, but in every one of his sichot, he rarely, if ever, employed nevuah or nevi'im as the prism through which he experienced Eretz Yisrael or explained Eretz Yisrael to us. Instead, what was his prism? His prism was halacha. He'd be very fond of quoting source number one to us, Amar Amemar, Chacham Adiv Minavi. And he felt as if this Gemara poised the two experiences. There's wisdom and chachma and halacha, and there's nevuah. And of course, the Gemara is discussing it in a very, very limited context of legal jurisdiction, that a Navi has no role through the process of Beis Din. But to Rav Lichtenstein, this became almost a slogan. That I'm not a Navi, and I don't expect nevuah until it's actually restored to be actively involved in processing and navigating this experience. That's why I was so excited that Rabbi Trump chose the example you spoke about before when trying Bizayon versus Kavod. Part of it was Rav Lichtenstein comes from the Brisker dynasty, and the Brisker dynasty always superimposes halachic vehicles to understand life. That's the thesis of Ish Halacha. If you haven't read Ish Halacha, I recommend it, that the consummate halachaist is so engrossed in the world of halacha that when he walks outside and sees a bus stop, he's not really seeing a bus stop, he's seeing a sukkah, he's seeing a possible Eruv, he's seeing a Rosh HaYachid, he's seeing an Oel HaMeis. Halacha is so deeply infused through our veins that it becomes, as the Rav said, I'm not quoting him, becomes the lens through which we perceive reality. And Rav Lichtenstein is part of that Brisker dynasty, although he often disagreed with the intensity of the Rav's assumption. I remember when Rav Lichtenstein quoted that example to us, and he was very intellectually honest. He would disagree with himself all the time, and he would disagree with Rav, even though Rav Soloveitchik was his mentor. He felt as if you're allowed to see a bus stop as a bus stop, and you're meant to see a tree as a tree, not just a Gemara in Makos, the Shadina Nafu Basar Ikaro. Rav Lichtenstein was very adamant that we not abdicate real experience. But part of it was Rav Lichtenstein had a very, very deeply Brisker genetic makeup, and the prism for everything was halacha or halacha constructs. But it was really more than that. It wasn't just the employment of halacha through his Brisker tendencies, but I think he felt it was solid ground, and it was a more, in his mind, response. By the way, I'm not stating this because I agree with it. I'm very drawn to people in Eretz Yisrael who do engage in trying to decipher prophecy and nevuah in a very responsible way through the modern experiences. But Rav Lichtenstein didn't. And I want to give you a few examples, and then I want to let him speak for himself. So example number one was Chanukah 1997, I think, 1996. And right around the time that Hebron was was delivered to the Palestinian Authority. It was a very, very complex time in yeshiva. The mesiva was ready to happen. The instruments were all prepared. The band had been practicing for weeks. Now, life in yeshiva, don't listen, whoever is going to go to yeshiva, life in yeshiva is very boring. The same thing day in, day out, to meet a kesidrum, another seder, another. So when you get to dance and sing, these are moments. These are real. There's not much. We don't have much excitement in yeshiva. It's all the same. When you speak to your son, how is yeshiva? We learned. What did you do today? We learned. That's why the conversations are 3 minutes long. There's not much happening. But we couldn't have a regular mesiva while we're returning Hebron. So Rav Lichtenstein had to try to help us calibrate our attitude. On the one hand, he was hopeful. This was still during the period that there was great hope associated with this process. And this wasn't a political statement, but there was still hope that this could lead to saving lives and possibly a political stabilization. But it's Eretz Avos. If you asked me to deliver a shir on Chanukah, the Chag that we celebrate in Malchus, and try to process the relinquishing of Hebron, I would turn back to Parshas Chayesara. I would look at Sefer Yeshaya. I would think about Churban Beis HaMikdash. And why did Rav Lichtenstein choose to talk about that night? Well, there's a halacha that's quoted in one Gemara called Vitor. Vitor means where one neighbor reneges on their rights unilaterally. I don't really care. You can trespass in my field. And then there's another sugya called Pshara, where two litigants who are involved in din, instead of waiting for Beis Din to deliver a verdict, they reach some arbitration, external, extrajudicial arbitration. So Rav Lichtenstein wanted us to process this relinquishing of Hebron, not as vitor, yeah, I don't care, just get rid of it, we don't care about Hebron, it's yours, but as pshara, where we're sitting with the other party, and we have something that we need, and they have something that they need, and we're hopeful, and there's engaged. This was a sicha at a mesiba Hanukkah night. It didn't sound that way. It was a sheer klali. He went to the Tosfos and the Rashba and the Karen Ara. It was an hour-long conversation of the halachic issues because he wanted to make sure that though we were relinquishing, it wasn't apathetic or indifferent, and let's get rid of it as quickly as possible in the way that Vitor is, but it's more like a pshara, where we're engaged in some long-standing process with his mutual benefit, and we initiate it, and we're still concerned with it. It's a very, very abstract way to teach his Talmidim about how to process the return of the city of Chevra. But it was more than that, because he was worried that possibly we may forget about Chevra, because we're no longer visiting it as often. Oh, Baruch Hashem, we've been able to, but then we didn't really know whether we'd have access, how often we'd be there. So he wanted to tell us about two different types of forgetting. What type of forgetting was legitimate? What type of forgetting was inappropriate? So what did he quote? He quotes the Mishnah in Avos. The Mishnah in Avos says that if you forget your Torah, then you're chayiv misa. But the Mishnah in Avos draws a distinction. I just quoted the source for you, source number 6. Yachal, line number 3, afilu takva lav mishnah. So let's say you forget because you have too much to remember, too much on your mind. Then you're not guilty. You're only guilty if you actively forget, whatever that means, actively forget. So he was encouraging us to still remain engaged with Chevron, not to actively forget, but if it falls out of consciousness because we're less available in Chevron, then that's legitimate. This is a very powerful message to us, and it's not the way Rav Amital spoke, and it's not the way most of the leaders of the national religious circle spoke. It's a very powerful sense, and it was very grounding, because we look back to Chazal to find a roadmap in terms of processing these events in our relationship to Eretz Yisrael. It was the 50th year, 20 years ago. You think the 70th year. We didn't have 50 for 50. The 50th year, gala celebrations. How would you experience? What sefer would you open? What images, what numbers would you? For Rav Lichtenstein, it was obvious. It was Yovel. But he carefully deconstructed Yovel into its constituent parts. What are the mitzvahs of Yovel? Well, there's blowing the shofar, which is a spiritual call of Malchus Hashem. And there is freeing of slaves, which means we need a society of social justice. And there's the restoration of land, so we need an economically sound. So he spoke for us within an hour, a State of the Union, where we are 50 years later on these three areas. Have we blown the shofar well enough? And have we called people to spiritual awakening? Have we created a society of justice and equality? And have we created a society of commercial and economic robust activity? And there's no mention of any nevuah, of any yirmiyah, of any crossing drawer bars of chol yoshveha. So it's very brisker and very Talmudist based, but it was also very, very grounded. He was a chacham. He wasn't a navi. My final example is when he told us about which parak in Tanakh he thought about as a youngster when the Medinat Yisrael was formed. Now, he was retelling the story as an adult, so obviously he was processing his youth through an adult mind and an adult. But ask yourself that question. What perek in Tanakh springs to mind when you think about Medinas Yisrael or 1948? Shir HaShirim, Ezra, pick any Haftarah in Yeshaya during the Shiva de Nechemta in the summer. These are home runs, slam dunks, they're obvious. Hisari, Sari, Kivarech, Kumironi, Kivarech, Aniasara, Laruchama, Batavatsiana, Zavani Hashem. I mean, these are psukim that roll off of our tongues. Which parak did Rav Lichtenstein think about? He related to us? Tehillim, parak chafes. Keili, keili, lama zavtani. Rachok mishuasi. He was fearful as a child. This is such a fledgling state. Then the parak concludes. I just included certain excerpts from the Keli Kemi Lama Zatani, source number 9. Elokaya Kraya Mamvalo Taneh, I'm calling out to you, please answer me. I trust you. Tiyatago Chimi Beta, Navtiche Al Shtei Mi. I was in a high school this morning, and one of the boys asked me after I gave a presentation about Rav Aaron, what did you feel? I said, we just felt Har Sinai. This presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was so palpable in this man's life. You walked away feeling you were literally descending from Har Sinai. You felt he was able to bring the Rabbeinu Shalom into the Shir Room. And into his experience, you felt it. You felt the Kedusha. Not the Kedusha, you felt the Shechina. You felt mamash the Shechina, b'korvay HaKadosh, b'zoz yavar, you felt his union HaKadosh HaKadoshim. And there's a story about when he was taken to the hospital, in an ambulance a few years before he died. He had many incidents, and then he was spoken about at the Hesped. And on the way to the hospital, in a semi-hallucinatory state, because he had fallen, I think he had some drugs, and he was just shouting at the top of his lungs in the ambulance, "Biyadcha afkid ruchi podisosi, biyadcha afkid ruchi podisosi, I'm giving you my neshama, Hashem," screaming. This sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the room was palpable. And this was the Perek in Tehillim, which he felt helped him experience 1948. So this is the theme alert, that Rav Lichtenstein was a chacham, he wasn't a navi, and there's a bracing of the experience of Hireshet Smichas Gulaseinu, which this voice and this attitude provided. Let me conclude this part by letting him speak for himself. Okay? And I want to trace two different conversations that took place 50 years apart with two completely different people. They couldn't be different, more different, in totally different parts of the world, but the shell of the conversation is almost identical to the point that it's eerie. And I photostated for you. That's how important these conversations are. If you take a look, if you turn to page number, I hope it came out. Yes. It's on the back page. It's on the back page. Rav Lichtenstein in 1962 first visits Eretz Yisrael. Who does he report to? His Rebbe. Who is his Rebbe in 1962? Not the Rav. Rav Huttner. He reports back to Rav Huttner. So on the back of the page, Rav Aaron recounts, "I went to see, line number 4, Mori v'Rabbi Rav Huttner, who used to spend summers in Eretz Yisrael. He had an attachment to Eretz Yisrael. He studied in Yeshivas Chevron. He began to ask me, what are my impressions? What do I see there?" So Rav Lichtenstein lists all of his impressions. And you can pretty much, and I've quoted some sources for you just to be able to appreciate them. Rav Lichtenstein feels, well, first of all, you can perform more mitzvot. And Rav Aaron quoted to us very often the Gemara in Sota, source number 12. Ibn Imam Nisave Moshe Rabbeinu Likanis L'Eretz Yisrael. Why was Moshe so covetous? Why do you want to come into Eretz Yisrael? Because Harbe Mitzvos Istavu Yisrael, Ve'im Iskayim in Eretz Yisrael. There's so many mitzvos I can't perform in Chutz La'aretz. Here's an opportunity. And he's just so excited and so enthusiastic for the chance of mitzvos. And not just more mitzvos, but mitzvos at a deeper level. The famous Ramban claims that mitzvos in Chutz La'aretz are practice runs, they're exhibition season, they're trials, they're training grounds, but mitzvos are only really authentic if performed in Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban writes, source number 13, we perform mitzvahs in Cedarhurst. By and large, we don't accept this Ramban. But the Ramban claimed that we perform mitzvahs in Chutz La'aretz, so that when we come back to Eretz Yisrael, we'll be on our game. These will be familiar to us. But they're just shell mitzvahs. They're not authentic experiences. Rav Lichtenstein would tell us that Rav Huttner, when he landed in Eretz Yisrael, would put on tefillin a second time. Because he felt as if he hadn't yet been mekayim the full mitzvah of tefillin until he got to Eretz Yisrael. I don't know if he made a bracha, but he liked tefillin a second time. So Rav Aaron talked to Rav Huttner about mitzvos. And Rav Aaron talked to Rav Huttner about living in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Source number 15, he would quote the Rav Tos, a lot based on this Gemara in Tainis, Eretz Yisrael Mashke Osa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Biatzma. That rain, unfortunately today we've seen and we felt how rain can be tragic, but rain in Chutz La'aretz is just part of the natural system of condensation and evaporation. But in Eretz Yisrael, every drop of rain is divinely dictated. And that's why Rav Soloveitchik felt that the lack of rainfall in Eretz Yisrael is not just a national crisis that warrants a fast day, but the lack of rainfall in Eretz Yisrael is a sign of Hester Panim. It's a special sign that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has removed his attention from Am Yisrael, and it requires a response completely different than a war, or completely different because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't provide rain in Eretz Yisrael, it's literally Hester upon him. So Rav Aaron spoke to Rav Huttner about mitzvot. So Rav Aaron spoke to Rav Huttner about Eretz Yisrael as the epicenter of Jewish history. Here quote for us the Rambam. The Rambam claims that even though today, source number 16, even though today our schedule of Rosh Chodesh and Yom Tovim has been preordained, but it still is only valid because there's the potential to have a Beis Din in Yerushalayim, the Sanhedrin. If there wouldn't be a potential for a Sanhedrin in Eretz Yisrael, no calendar could set any dates. It's almost as if there's a virtual Sanhedrin operating in Eretz Yisrael through which Shmuel HaKatan was able to set our calendar. And the Rambam writes, in a very, very powerful statement, independent of this year, The Rambam writes source number 16. If it were possible that there would never be a Jewish community in Yerushalayim, then the calendar could never be set, but is almost a promise that Jews will never be absent from Eretz Yisrael. There will always be even a fledgling Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, based on that foreknowledge, the calendar could be set, because it's impossible to imagine a reality in which there isn't a Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Aaron talked about the mitzvahs, and Rav Aaron talked about living in the presence of the Bona Shalom, and Rav Aaron talked about, at which point, go to the back page, please. So Rav Hunter keeps asking Rav Lichtenstein, I'll start with line number 7. I discussed with him the vitality of Jewish life in the sense of total community as opposed to the diaspora. He felt, Rav Hutner, you could have had that in East Europe, in Eastern Europe. I said there's a broader range of application in halacha. He said, Rav Hutner says back to Rav Lichtenstein, last line in the first paragraph, you could have had that in Eastern Europe or North Africa. So I tried to get Rav Hutner to elaborate, Rav Aaron says, and Rav Hutner shouts, he exclaims, why don't you mention the uniqueness of being in Eretz Yisrael? Not because of more mitzvahs and not because it's the epicenter of history, just the magic of being in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Aaron writes, it was stunning to him to meet a Ben Torah on an airplane flying to Israel whose attitude was the same as if we were going to California. You're going to Israel alone, you could be going to California for the same price. So Rav Aaron says, I walked out of that meeting with a partner like a beaten dog. This thought, this feeling is what I want to share with you. So that conversation took place in 1962 between a younger Rav Lichtenstein and his Rebbe Rav Hutner. And Rav Lichtenstein is falling back on halacha, Hester Panim, and Eshem Lokechaba, the epicenter of Jewish history. But he's not discussing Nevuah. He's not discussing Shir HaShir. Fast forward to around 2012, 50 years later. A great book I recommend for everyone if you want to get a sense of who Rav Aaron was, because his writings are very oblique, they're very difficult to penetrate. Rav Sabato, who in and of himself is a tremendous, tremendous person. You talk about humility and just carrying yourself nonchalantly. He's the Rosh Yeshiva Malei Adumim, incredible person. I would pay money just to sit at his table, just to watch him. That's how much depth he has. He interviewed Rav Lichtenstein in a book called Seeking My Presence, or in Hebrew, Mevakshei Panecha. There's a chapter there about Eretz Yisrael. Fascinating book. Highly, highly recommended. And they're having a conversation about, you can well imagine, secular Zionism. But at some point, it's on the back of the second to last page, Rav Sabato asks as follows. You spoke about all these issues of the State of Israel. But then he says, line number 4, there's much more to the establishment of the state than what you talked about. It's the realization of the dreams of generations, the visions of the prophets, the beginning of redemption. So here's Rav Sabato feeding Rav Aaron a fastball. Here it is. Talk about prophecy. Talk about geula. Talk about dreams. And Rav Kook's followers, Rav Sabato said, saw it that way. They see a historical event that brings to fruition the Nevuos. And now, Rav Sabato has the ultimate ace in his pocket. He says, not only am I asking you that question, not only did Rav Kook's followers see it that way, even your teacher and mentor, Rav Soloveitchik, wrote about it in his essay called Odi Dofek. The Rav has an essay about the fifth parak of Shir HaShirim, where Hashem comes knocking, which he feels is about the state of Israel. So why don't you talk in those terms, Rav Sabato asks Rav Aaron 50 years later. So Rav Aaron responds, last page, front cover, I don't know to what degree called Odi Dofek reflects the Rav's approach. It was a successful work, but it was written in the spirit of this Israeli Independence Day when the country was taking roots. It was at such a moment that the Rav said what he said. How do you get any clearer than that? Rav Sabato was begging you for an answer, and he's quoting your Rebbe, Muvak. And Rav Aaron says, didn't really mean it. It was just written at the time. It was a period piece. Didn't really mean it. That's a major change. And it probably should be associated with a different change, but related. There are certain people who change the course of Torah through history. Think about the Rama. If you told someone in the year 1450, you're going to study Torah in Poland, he'd look at you like you're crazy. Torah in Poland? There's no one in Poland. Everyone's in Germany. Well, you're going to study Torah in Poland. The Rama in the 16th century moves to Poland, and Poland becomes the powerhouse of Torah for 400 years. Who else changed? Moshe Feinstein, Aaron Cutler. They transformed this country. Look around you. People who changed the face of Torah. Rashi's grandchildren. Rashi, in the 11th century, had to study Torah in Germany. He was known in France. There wasn't a base medrash in France. 20 years later, Yaakov Yishtam and Shmuel and Riva, all of a sudden France becomes, tragically, because of the way French authorities treated Jews in Torah, but I look at Rav Lichtenstein that way. Many people in Chutz La'aretz bemoan the fact that he moved because he was the appointed successor of Rav Soloveitchik, and the American Jewish community would have been totally different had Rav Lichtenstein and all of his Talmidim stayed here. I probably would have less jet lag because I don't know that I would be in Eretz Yisrael if my Rebbe would have stayed here. But you don't see what happened on the other side. The Hesder movement, which has essentially become the cornerstone of the national religious community, because the community can't exist without its yeshivas. It's yeshivas creating Torah. The Hesder movement was in its infancy, was an embryo, and its fuel was essentially Talmidim of Rav Kook. Those were the people who were leading this process. Rav Lichtenstein took the Lithuanian yeshiva world and brought it to the Hesder world. He was the primary force in bridging that new Torah, and it's a new Torah formula, serving in the army, studying Tanakh, learning Machshava. It's not just a continuation. Hesder is not exactly a continuation of our past experiences. But he's responsible for creating that Lithuanian classic sense. We would have regularly conversations in yeshiva, panel conversations in Hanukkah, in which the topic was Gersh and Volozhin. What are the differences? And the premise was that basically they're the same, but we have to try to be sensitive to the differences. He would quote Yiddish to us in the shir. In front of 500 Israelis, he didn't speak a word of Yiddish. And then he translated in Hebrew. But it was his way of reminding us you come from somewhere. And don't underestimate how important and pivotal that anchoring is. I was thinking, just on the way over tonight, I was thinking about Rav. Rav changed the course of history of Torah. Rav, when Rav moved to Bavel, in 237, it was the second descent from Bav to Bavel, and he forms the yeshiva, great, great yeshiva of Surah, Shabbos already teaching in Naharda. At that point, Bavel becomes the central location of Torah, because Rav moved there. And why was Rav such a pivotal figure? Because there's the Beit Talmud Chacham and all the other aspects involved. His Rebbe was Rav Huna, but he also learned by Rav Yehuda Hanasi. And he was able to bridge people back to the Torah of Eretz Yisrael, in Tveria. And you find very often in the Tanayim, people were given greater import because they had three generations, not just the Rebbe, because they were bridges. Oh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, I'm sorry, Rabbi Elazar ben Yeshua, you mentioned that these are the Rabbanim of Rabbi Akiva. Their Rebbe was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, but they also learned from Shammai and Hillel. And the sense of continuity in Masara, I don't know where the Hesder world would be today if Rav Lichtenstein hadn't moved. I do know where it is. It would have been driven solely by Rav Kook's Talmidim. And though Rav Kook learned from Volozhin, that wasn't his world. His world became a very different world, and the lumdus wasn't the same, and the thought process wasn't the same. So it wasn't just the way he helped us process Geula and Mashiach, it was also a sense of continuity and bringing Lithuania and the Yeshiva Shevelt. And by the way, just as an aside, I think in our community, we don't stress this enough. I think the Haredi Shevelt has appropriated the pre-European yeshiva welt is theirs in a way that we sometimes don't associate with them. Rabbi Chanan was ours, and the Chafetz Chaim was ours, and the Aros Sameach was ours, and because they did or didn't say something anti-Zionist, it's all, you can't extrapolate from what someone said in 1920 in Vienna to 2018 usually. It just doesn't match. So I don't see it necessarily. I don't come from the world of Rav Palm and Rav Aaron Cutler and Lakewood. That's not where I was trained and learned. No way into it. I love those that world, but that's not my Masara. I have a different Masara. But my Masara is the Chafetz Chaim, my Masara is Rebbe Chanan, and my Masara is the Chafetz is Reb Chaim, my Masara is Arsim. You walk into my shir room, you'll see a picture of the altar of Slobodka on the wall and a picture of Rebbe Chanan. And I think sometimes because we dress a little different and because we believe in a state that many of them discourage, it's just a different world. There was even college. The fear that they lived in for college education and that led them to denounce college, or Baruch Ber Leibowitz's famous denunciation, because college was a hotbed of agnosticism and atheism. You walked into college, Today, that's what colleges are. People go off the derech because they study Milton. Halavai. Halavai, the reason that every boy and girl who's off the derech is because they study too much Shakespeare. Right? That's our biggest problem right now, that they're going to study too much. If everyone went home tonight and read an hour of Shakespeare, Mashiach will probably come tomorrow. Right? So I think somehow we do a disservice to ourselves, and Rav Aaron braced us very, very powerfully in that world. We felt as if we were learning from Rav Huttner, and we were back in Slobodka, and we were back in Volozhin, and even though it was new, it was just a spawning of some new direction rather than a complete revolution. So that's the first issue I wanted to stress. The second issue is Rav Aaron's stress on individualism as opposed to nationalism and collectivism. I don't think you appreciate fully how powerful national identity in Eretz Yisrael is. As much as you can be part of Eretz Yisrael and read about its events, living as a nation, serving together in the army, living as one cohesive unit, it begins to overcome your mentality. You start to process life in national terms. If I ask you, what do you own? You'll probably say, I own a lot of land on Central Avenue. If you ask an Israeli, what do you own? And the answer will be, well, right now we have the Shtachim, but we have to give back the Golan. The answer is complete. The terminology is different. The thought process is where we are as a people. You celebrate days of independence together. You've all felt it, the powerful Nisias Kapayim at the Kotel, and the Duchening at the Kotel. And we celebrate together as one. And it's a very, very powerful sense of nationalism. And of course, Rav Kook and his Talmidim, who spurred this process, were hyper-nationalists, and not just nationalists at the cost of individualism, but also even cosmologists, that you're not just part of the nation, you're part of the universe that's in shifting, and when the Jews return to Eretz Yisrael, the entire universe is realigning, and you're part of that cosmological change. Rav Aaron restores the balance between collectivism and nationalism and individualism. And it's an extremely, extremely important shift. A word that he would use very often, you can see this in all of his sichot, he would constantly use this word. And he made up this term, he made up his own terms. The word was Rebbe Yisrael. Rebbe Yisrael. And the word Rebbe Yisrael was always accounted to Knesset Yisrael. There's Knesset Yisrael, our people, our nation. But there's also Rebbe Yisrael. You. You, your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, your Kiyama Mitzvos. And that Rebbe Yisrael existed before Medinas Yisrael and before Knesset Yisrael had a physical incarnation, Baruch Hashem, in the way that we have today. And it was that restoration of individualism, or the balancing between individualism and collectivism, that was so crucial. Because sometimes nationalism can come at the cost of individualism. Sometimes the national agenda may blur or conceal. Take, for example, how interested, some would say obsessed, but how interested we are in extra land and returning to our homeland and that national agenda. Well, are we as excited about Talmud Torah, our personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kiyama Mitzvos? So let me share with you a conversation between Rav Lichtenstein and Shimon Peres in 1978. I photostated it for you because I think it's so reflective. Shimon Peres visits the yeshiva in 1978. So he asked Rav Aaron, it's on the second page, what's the political credo of the yeshiva? I can imagine how 99% of Rosh Yeshivas would answer. We're right, we're left, we believe in this party, we belong to this party, we support this agenda, pro-army, post-army, separate units. So listen to how Rav Aaron answers Shimon Peres. By the way, you can just cut and paste this and live your life by this, and you'd be fine. You'd be ready to go. Three principles. Number one, even when sitting in the Beis Medrash, you have a responsibility to the community. Number two, when addressing these problems, you have to think deeply and not simplistically. Number three, even when doing what is right, you have to know how to respect other opinions and people who hold them. Tell Shimon Peres. And what do you believe about the state of Israel? That's what I really was asking. What I believe about my Talmidim is we're people. Who are we as people? And how do we grow spiritually as Ovdei Hashem, as individuals, as part of this collective? That's a second major, major change. Major, major difference. And in part, it's what I would say makes Rav Lichtenstein probably a little bit more amenable when it was still relevant. Again, this is all going to sound anachronistic because peace today is sadly, unfortunately, an elusive, I don't say joke, chas v'shalom, you don't trivialize peace, but it's just so elusive and so seemingly improbable. But there were periods in which it seemed at least hopeful, and Rav Lichtenstein was amenable to it. And two of the issues he would constantly quote to us, and I think one issue cuts right down the middle of this contrast between collectivism and individualism. He spoke to us about pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh is not a factor that you consider at a national level, because if you would, you'd never go to war. If pikuach nefesh is docha kol ha'tara kula, then essentially you never go to war, because at every war you're going to suffer loss of life. So evidently, at a national level, and the Chinuch writes about this, the Minchas Chinuch argues, a very strange Minchas Chinuch, but evidently, at a national level, pikuach nefesh is a halacha for you and me, but it's not a chovas tzibur. It's not a factor that the tzibur has to take into account, or the melech. So in theory, you don't have to factor it in when making political decisions, but Rav Aaron constantly spoke with us about pikuach nefesh, about saving a particular individual's life. And the second issue that he spoke to us a lot about was the fact that this national agenda comes at the cost of other areas of spiritual development. And we become so what's the major crisis for the national religious parties in government? Anytime there's a dip in the right-wing agenda. What's a major crisis for the Haredi parties? There's not enough Talmud Torah or religious issues. And we've abdicated the religious platform. We're concerned with how many settlements we'll build and how our sovereignty will be extended. And somehow we've abdicated that flag that we also stand for Torah and mitzvahs. And that starts to, and I think you see this in the change in our leadership. I say this with all proper respect, but there was someone who actually talked, I think it was an article in one of the Israeli newspapers around Rav Aaron's death, that a microcosm of the crisis in the national religious world is that the leader used to be Rav Lichtenstein, he's now passed, and the new leader is Naftali Bennett. I'm not saying disrespect to Naftali Bennett, but it's a complete paradigm shift. It's impossible to say those two people in the same sentence. They're so different. And somehow, Rav Aaron felt that this national agenda was coming at the cost of some of that personal growth. So, those are the two primary issues. I know it's getting late, so I'll be a little bit brief. I want to discuss one or two secondary issues. I would say that if you ask me to give one of the 10 modifiers or qualifiers of Rav Lichtenstein, it's hard to even make that list or condense the list. One of them is that he was a humanist. And as a humanist, he believed deeply in the human spirit. He believed in the goodness of man and the virtue of man. I think he restored to us that belief. I think I teach a lot of younger people, younger adults, and I think the world of Facebook and social media has created a view of the world as cynical, because those are the people who grab the headlines and the attention. I think a lot of the younger generation does not see the world through the virtuous lenses that we're meant to see the world, that Hashem created human beings with Tzelem Elokim, and 99% of the people in this world are kind and compassionate, and I think we've lost some of that. We have to try to protect or restore that. I think to a degree of Lichtenstein helped restore that, not just by what he said. The Rambam, going a little bit off-road now, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Hasel de'Atara about a Navi. And a Navi is someone that improves their moral character and builds their wisdom and their values and their, so that they become a candidate for prophecy. Hashem then decides whether, but Hashem won't deliver prophecy arbitrarily. You have to be that ubermensch, that person who, and the question is, we no longer live through a world of Nevuah, so why does the Rambam spend so much time discussing Nevuah? Because evidently, it's that process of self-improvement and building all those milos that even without Nevuah is self-sufficient and important on its own right. And we literally saw that in Rav Aaron. We saw someone who was working on every single aspect of his Avodas Hashem, from his Midos to his Derech Eretz to his Chesed to his Davet. He just felt as if this is what man is meant to be. This is how Kodesh Baruch Hu expects us to be. And we knew we can never reach it. It was astoundingly absurd to even begin to think in those terms. But it showed us what a human being could be. It showed us the potential of mankind. And it made us believe and remind ourselves. Rav Aaron, in my opinion, was not Torah Mada in the same way that the Rav was. Rav Soloveitchik, in his writings, talks about how systems relate to each other. How does the world of Kant, Immanuel Kant, who spoke about morality, how does his view of morality clash or coincide with Jewish morality. How does the world of Hegel, the way he viewed history, face it? How does that... The Rav is always talking about systems. Rav Aaron was a humanist. And he believed in every single person. And he respected every single person. And he loved every single person. And if there was a Gentile who could articulate something which Chazal didn't because they were too busy or they didn't have the time and they could articulate it better than Chazal, then he wanted to read that and he respected that. When his father was blind, he told us he read Milton, John Milton's poem called Samson Agonistes about Shimshon going blind, which Milton wrote when he was blind in prison. So he was processing a poet who was blind in prison, writing about a hero who was blind in prison and trying to climb into his father's. Which Masechta will help you understand the mindset of a blind person? Quite frankly, Chazal were too busy. They were dealing with issues of far greater importance. I'll bring you a raya. Okay, here's the best raya. I'll prove to you that Rav Lichtenstein was different from the Rav. It was a Friday night sicha in yeshiva. His sichot in yeshiva were just endless. He would talk for an hour and a half minimum in his prime. It was a marathon just to make it through. It was the first night of the Charev Zman. It was Parshas Bereishis. Everyone's falling asleep in the front row. And Rav Aaron's going on and on about Adam HaRishon and the fall of Adam and the fall of Adam. We're falling for Shluffin, for Shluffin. And then he screams out. And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. All of a sudden, 50 American heads shoot up. Did he just quote Humpty Dumpty? Evidently, evidently, that statement is a metaphor for the fall of man. That man fell so precipitously that all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't rehabilitate man. After the shiur, the Israelis came over to us and said, Misa Humpty Dumpty, is this a good Can anyone in this room imagine the Rav quoting Humpty Dumpty? It's unimaginable. The Rav didn't operate in that sphere. He was in the high road of high philosophy and what the Kantians had said and the Greeks. And Rav Aaron was just, he quoted these unknown cardinals in the 18th century who just were very frum in opposing secularizing influences. And he quoted people who helped them understand the complexity of the human condition. There's a very, very different feel. And my raya is, although someone actually brought Akasha, Eli Weber, I know he's from this area, quote Akasha, I never heard Rav Aaron use the following word. He never used the word Lahavdil. Never. Someone showed me a recording in which he used it, but it was a strange way. And I don't think he felt, he was standing in the Beis HaMikdash, he was trying to be an Oved Hashem, and if people had things to say, he listened. But it wasn't as if he was walking out temporarily to then understand the system and fuse the two. He was trying to be an Oved Hashem, how can it be the best Oved Hashem? And I just happen to trust human beings, so... If this person or that person had a very enlightening or helpful comment, I want to read it and take it seriously and apply it to my avodas Hashem. But it was that humanism that also created a significant change in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, in our return, has been driven, Baruch Hashem, by a movement of nationalism. Zionism is just a fancy word for Jewish nationalism. And we're returning to our homeland, and we're thinking about nationhood, and this is a home that's geared for Jewish people. Obviously, we're hosting others, and Jewish history, and who we are as a people, and our national arc, and our... There are other people in this world, and they're part of our lives. They're not just store figures. And you know what? Many of them are opposed to our returning to Eretz Yisrael. And some of them actually live in Eretz Yisrael and have legal rights to Eretz Yisrael and have national ambitions that are just as fervent as ours. And they're having Thursday night shiur in their local mosques as well. That's a tremendous, tremendous challenge. And there are movements and tendencies in our camp that border on dismissal and sometimes even xenophobia. Not just to the Arab terrorist, but just to anyone who's not Jewish or anyone. And Rav Lichtenstein would have none of that. Would have none of that. Do you know who was crying at his Levaya the most? At his Besa, the Shiva? Amongst a group of people crying were the Arab Palestinian workers in Yeshiva. They were bawling like babies. Muhammad and Ishmael and Eid. Because Rav Aaron, every Arab Rosh Hashanah, would walk over to each of them personally and wish them a Shana Tova. He was very busy at Rosh Hashanah. And he knew their wives' names and their children's names. He wished them a Shana Tova, which speaks about his Derech Eretz, but also speaks about the Kavod HaAdam that he had. for every single human being. I remember 2 weeks ago, when I came 2 weeks ago, I was driving to the airport, and I came to a traffic circle, and I saw an Arab car waiting to pass, Palestinian car, and I saw a Jewish car leap ahead of him. And it was my right of way, and I ushered the Arab car to go ahead of him. And I was thinking about it. I said, how much suffering do Palestinians undergo on our roads? And they have to. Unfortunately, they have to. Because you don't know the one terrorist amongst the 10,000. So all 10,000 have to wait 2 hours for a trip that will take me 20 minutes in the stifling hot day. So the least I can do is, for this moment, let him take the right of way. So it'll take me an extra second to get where I'm going. It's not going to make a major difference. But let him feel as if he can drive. It's his road as well. He has my respect as a human being. That's about Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron used to give tramps to Palestinians. He would take Palestinian women in his car until he was told it's just too dangerous. And there's that. And that's the great irony of yeshiva. I mean, yeshiva, essentially, is the most successful settlement in Israel. If you think about the most successful settlement, the two words that come to mind are Gush Etzion and Male Adumim. But the Gush block has become the most successful settlement. And it's such a great irony in that this man who was such a humanist in an environment of such hyper-nationalism, Baruch Hashem, I'm proud to be a nationalist, but it has to be threaded with a universal sense of where we are as a people and our responsibilities to others, and we're sharing the planet with others. And you've seen, those of you who spend time in Eretz Yisrael, you can feel, by the way, there are dangers here as well in the insular community of the five towns about how you view the other and what role they play in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world. It's fueled by a different danger. And that's at the core of our challenges of the Hashem, to become nationalist and universalist and to merge the two and to realize that the two are the same, just at this point of history, they seem to clash. But ultimately, our agenda is L'sakin Olam M'malcho Shakai and to bring universal welfare for the entire world. And we do that by studying Torah, wearing tefillin, performing chesed, settling our land. But it's a very, very important issue, far beyond the context of this year. One final issue, and then I'll, just because we're running out of time, with that, I hope you see how pivotal and how influential he was to the Israeli society. Rav Aaron didn't just have Rabbi Trump, Derech Eretz. He was the consummate institutionalist. He felt respect for institutions. He lent himself to institutions. I can't begin to tell you, I was talking about this with someone today, how much respect and love he had for Rabbanim. He was so collegial with Rabbanim. It just felt like he's a Rav and he's part of something larger and he's working together with this Rav. When one of the Talmidim in Yeshiva, Rabbi Engel from Chicago, was once at an educators conference and he asked Rav Aaron a question, and Rav Aaron turned to Rabbi Engel and said, well, you and I are educators and we have to pay. What do you mean you and I? In what language are you and I part of the same sense? But that's how he made you feel. I work with him. I mean, one of the challenges of my life is I had to spend 20 years admissions and recruiting. I did it basically because I wanted to help Rav Aaron out, because he was handling it all by himself, all the tests and all the admissions. I would work with him for 20 years on who to accept, whom not to accept, who to test. And basically, he empowered me to be his boss. And I'm looking at him. I'm a 30-year-old color guy. Why are you asking me? Just take whoever you want. Because to a degree, it wasn't just humility. It was also institutionalism. And that was not an easy trait to believe in during the years that much of the national religious leadership became polarized. During the 90s and the 2000s, the Oslo Accord, the disengagement from Gaza, Amona, it led to a polarization where the national religious leaders felt that we were on the outside. And it was our job to take hardline stance and to oppose the concessions and the frivolity of the government and their decisions. And Rav Aaron always saw himself as an insider. And he always encouraged us and trained us to respect the offices and the institutions of government, policemen and army and prime ministers. And to a degree, that's why he had a constant stream, even today. Bugi Ayalon was just in yeshiva 2 days ago. He's one of the most leftist political people in the spectrum. Everyone knows, not because of the moderate stances of yeshiva, because they know there's an institutionalism in yeshiva. This is our country. And that's really at the core of Dati Lomi. The Haredim have drawn a line in the sand. They don't want in. They want whatever needs they feel are important to their community, and we're on the other side of the line, and we're not part of your institution. Ideologically, we're part of the institution politically, because we want the money and we want the benefits. We want in. And you have to realize the army and the government knows we want in, and they exploit that. So we're constantly sitting at staff meetings in yeshiva where the army will say, well, we want your boys to serve more in the army. We want a little bit more time and a little bit more. And the Haredim will have nothing of it because we're not interested in participating. But they know that they have a soft spot because when they respond, the army has more manpower needs. That's our issue. That's our problem. It's not your problem. It's our problem because we're insiders. And unfortunately, within the national religious community, as you've seen over the last couple of years, statements about government and encouraging people to disobey orders. That's something that Rav Lichtenstein deeply, deeply entrenched in our community. Respect for institutions, respect for the institutions in Eretz Yisrael in particular. There's more, but it's late and it's Thursday night. You can begin to appreciate how much of an impact his leaving us, our community here, but radically changing Eretz Yisrael. To the end of his life, he received the Israel Prize 2-3 years before he died. There's a short video clip. And in some interview, I remember him saying, in his very, very self-effacing, humorous manner, who would have thought that I'm such a Zionist? Like, he didn't see himself that way. And he receives the highest non-military prize in the state of Israel, along with this famous actor, and this famous musician, this famous politician. And he just said, it's about facts on the ground, and about being in Eretz Yisrael. And I can't tell you how many people, when he was Nifter, I revisited my own life. And I said, you know what? You have to stop taking credit for making Aliyah. I didn't make Aliyah. I went to Be'er Tzvi'ah. It was obvious to me in 1993, there's only one place when I started my family I wanted to live. And it wasn't just because I wanted to be with him. It's because I processed my Aliyah through his lenses because he actually did it. And he gave up everything that he would have enjoyed and been able to contribute in this. I remember in the 80s sitting in this freezing cold lunchroom in Gush Etzion without heat, eating cold schnitzels and leaky roofs. And there's Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Tova Soloveitchik Lichtenstein sitting with 30 Israelis talking about Parshas Acharemos. And I said, what would it have been like if he stayed in America? He'd be speaking to thousands. He'd be in fancy settings. He'd be enjoying lavish meals. And he'd be the leader of the Jewish people. And here he is. And every time I had those doubts and every time I had those questions, I just felt his force pulling me. Well, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein moved to Gush Etzion. You're nothing. You're not even. If he could make that move, of course you can. So that power that we lived our own Aliyah through him, which isn't an idea. I was speaking a few weeks ago. There's a panel: the Rav's views of Israel and the Rav Aaron's views of Israel. And this was, we complimented each other. He spoke about the Rav. I spoke about Rav Aaron. The Rav didn't live in Israel. Rav Aaron did. Rav Aaron made Aliyah. And we're able to process it in a very, very deeply personal experience through his eyes. So, there's much more to Rav Aaron than his impact in Eretz Yisrael, as you know, but I thought this is a topic that doesn't always get as much attention. Everyone's drawn, of course, to his Chachma and his Talmud Chacham and the Torah and the Mitos and the Derech Eretz. But he spoke with us about this a lot. He braced it with halachic constructs. He girded us against irresponsible messianic activity or thought. He tilted the balance back towards a healthy calibration between individualism and collectivism or nationalism. His humanism was a very powerful insertion. I think he bridged us back to a world that we come from. And we do best to anchor ourselves to more than I think we do, to remind ourselves that we're from that world as well. Everyone have a good Shabbos.